Toad Stern being Totus Stern, thanks. Yes. Being recorded on January 16th, 1976. And this is Rosalind Baxendall. And we'll begin with Charlotte on her early years.
Yes. I am a first-generation American. Both my parents came from Tsarist Russia. My father came in 1890 from Kovna, now Lithuania, and my mother from Vilna, now Lithuania, in 1892. They were under 20 years of age, but already my father had had a good education in Russia, and my mother, while literate in Yiddish, had had some training in dressmaking. They met in Haverhill, Massachusetts, where my mother had come to live with her older brother, and my father had sought work in his textile and shoe town. Both became shoe factory workers. They were married in 1893 in Haverhill. I was the third and only living child out of four that my mother bore. The others were stillborn. A commentary on the state of medicine, and especially obstetrics at that time. Soon after my birth, my parents moved to Boston, where they hoped for better opportunities in trade, since factory work was not to either's liking. They settled in East Boston, a small suburb of Boston, largely populated by Jewish and Catholic families. Here, my mother set up a dressmaking shop and made wrappers, put that in quotes, so-called, but really house dresses. And my father became the salesman for the wrappers. He was an affable, good-looking man who mastered English easily and was soon well-liked among the tradesmen. But he was honest, somewhat naive, and could not engage in deception. He soon found that earning a living in this way was not easy. All around him were men who seemed to arrive at riches quickly, but he had to work harder than most to provide for the family. My mother, on the other hand, after 3 years of sewing, felt she owed it to me, she owed it to my future, to give it up and become a housewife. Do you want to stop there for a moment?
No, where did she get that idea?
I think that idea came from a general petty bourgeois outlook that many immigrants had, of wanting to do well in this society, to be comfortable, to perhaps have status in the Jewish community as people of means, and because it was an objective that my mother looked towards. She didn't want to be a permanent worker. She didn't want to have a career. She wanted to be a housewife, and she wanted to devote herself entirely to me. She had had so much trouble in having children that I was very precious as far as she was concerned.
Were they religious at all?
They were religious in the same sense that many Jewish families were. They went to synagogue on holidays. My mother kept semi-kosher house. Later it was not kosher really, but in the beginning it was. And she tried to abide by the traditions of her own family, which were, of course, Orthodox. However, I think both my mother and father were really not very oriented in that area, in religious matters. My father knew Hebrew, and he could go to the synagogue and repeat the prayers and so on. My mother was also, she also read the whatever she had to do during holidays and so on. But neither of them were really very devoted to the synagogue.
Did they have relatives in Haverhill or Boston?
My mother had two brothers in Haverhill. One family was quite poor and remained poor. The other family became very wealthy in time and became shoe factory owners themselves. Mm-hmm. And in my early days, I used to go to Haverhill very often.
See
my family. My father had no relatives whatsoever except two brothers in Johannesburg, South Africa, who had left home at the same time that he did, and they went to South Africa and he came to the United States.
Did they maintain an interest in what was happening in Russia, or contacts, or want to really cut themselves off?
They were essentially concerned with survival here. And I don't think that their interest in Russia was very profound at all. And I think they had no political interest. My mother's father was a Narodnik. And my mother remembers that he was always being pursued and always had to hide. And her mother had to carry on the family affairs and the small business they had. They were grain dealers or something. So my grandfather did have a revolutionary tradition of one sort. But I never got all the facts about him, except that my mother respected him enormously and said that he used to go out for long periods and teach the peasants how to read and write. And that's all she remembers.
And when the revolution came in the Soviet Union, were they interested?
Well, not especially, no. My mother's sister, who was in Vilna at the time, was quite anti-Bolshevik, and her husband was killed by the Red Army soldiers because he wouldn't give up any grain. He wanted to hoard the grain. See, so there was antagonism there. I would say that they lacked a political understanding.
And what about a trade union? Any trade union?
No trade union background at all. My mother was very much of an individualist, so was my father. They were just concerned about survival and getting along in a world which was strange to them. And my father was especially, I'll go on
okay,
with my father's a... Now, let's see, that's page one. When I was three, she closed the shop. She had done very well and thought the future secure. On the other hand, my father, now forced to sell other people's wares, did not have this confidence. As time went on, he became defeatist, despairing, and throughout my adolescence and early youth, I recall that he was a non-participant in the family, in the family period. In his spare time, sitting by the window, dreaming or reading, he was obviously worried and withdrawn to the point where he scarcely spoke. My mother, on the other hand, was now devoting herself mainly to me. I was the source of whatever joy she had in life, and she was determined to provide every opportunity for me that she had not had. Whatever my mother could do Our small tenement was always clean, bright, and nicely fitted with curtains. Whatever my mother could do by hand, she utilized to fill in the gaps where poverty showed. When I was eight, she obtained the services of an excellent piano teacher, had already bought a piano out of meager savings, and was eager to have me study music. She was also concerned about my Hebrew education and hired a young rabbinical student to teach me to read and write both Yiddish and Hebrew. At age 12, I was graduated from the Lyman School, an excellent elementary school in East Boston, although the young people whom I knew, especially members of a large, well-to-do family who were our landlords, were all planning to attend East Boston High School, my mother insisted that I must go to the best high school in Boston, one which would prepare me adequately for college. Although she spoke a limited English, she made inquiries everywhere and finally found that the girls' Latin school in the Back Bay of Boston was the one she deemed desirable.
Is that a private school?
No, it was a public school, but was almost always attended by the wealthy children of Back Bay of Boston.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a classical high school of enormous prestige in the country. Everybody
yes,
knew.
Yes, I've heard of it. I thought it was a private school.
No, she could not know that this was the school of the wealthy children of Boston. She understood only that here I would get the proper education to fit me for college. It was at this point that I noted disagreements between my parents. My father was urging that I take a commercial course to enable me to leave school after high school and add to the family income. This angered my mother. She would not hear of letting me bear the burdens of financial support of the family. And to reinforce this determination, she started dressmaking again to supplement the family needs. By this time, she had realized that my father felt himself a failure and that she would have to work hard to carry out her dream of sending me to college. My high school experience made me more aware than previously of class differences. There were many who laughed at my English, poor because Yiddish was spoken exclusively in my home, and I had little practice except in school to improve it. While I was an excellent student in Latin, Greek, and French, in English, English was always my poorest subject. It was my mother's ambition that I go to Radcliffe College, and she was hoarding her pennies for this, sewing late into the night. Often when my homework was finished, I would help her pull out bastings and do other routines of sewing, but for the most part, she would not let me learn any of her skills, whether it was dressmaking or cookery. In this atmosphere of limited cultural and social experiences, poverty and insecurity, there were nevertheless the insatiable aspirations of my mother, which influenced me more than schools and friendships. My life in school was always exciting to me. I made a few friends, but although I could compete with the other girls, my mother saw to it that I was always dressed well. I felt a sense of inferiority. This led me to the determination to acquire good English and to study and read the harder. My summers were spent in the library, reading the English classics. Occasionally, my mother arranged to spend a month at the seashore or in the country, but for the most part, my adolescence was spent in the company of books. It was soon clear that I would not be a musician, and regretfully, my lessons were discontinued to be taken up years later when I was financially independent.
Now, any specific books that you remember having an influence?
Well, I read George Eliot, and I read Thomas Hardy, and those stand out in my memory more than perhaps Jane Austen, whom I read. And let me see what else. I did not enjoy Dickens at that time, but I have learned to enjoy him very much since then.
Was your mother a feminist in any way?
No,
girls should be educated, because a lot of people
didn't.
She
was ambitious for me. She had something of the yearnings for her father, whom she knew was educated and who had been helping peasants to learn. And she idealized the thought that I would be an outstanding woman. She wanted me to be a person of some status in my community, and she was absolutely insatiable when it came to education. There was never anything, although we had very little money, my mother took me to all the plays in Boston. When there was a Shakespeare repertory, she bought repertory tickets for me to go. She couldn't afford to go herself, so I would go with a girlfriend. But I had to go to...
She really thought the way to rise in America was through education?
I think so. I think that was one of it, yes.
That was the one way out of
poverty,
the working class, yeah. Education.
Yeah, but
she believed the American dream.
Yeah, she did. She really did. She lived in that period when free enterprise was still very dominant in the country, when people were making enormous successes. And, of course, we were not in that situation, which she regretted very much. Had she continued to work, she might have been in that situation, but she didn't.
But some mothers might have thought a way to rise would be that you'd marry well.
Yes.
And it was important that she thought you could do it on your own, you know, that through learning rather than marriage.
Yeah, but she never talked to me about marriage. She never seemed to feel that was the goal, you see. As a matter of fact, I really recall her looking forward to the time when she might be a grandmother, which many of the people of that group did. Never. Her interest primarily was that I have the fullest possible opportunity in this land of opportunity, as she saw it. And she was quite different from the women of her own group, some of whom were now well-to-do, because they didn't care about educating their daughters. They were interested in educating their sons, but not their daughters. And she had quite a different attitude in that respect. Now, I don't know how to attribute this to any special ideas that she had. I know that there was a period in Boston when she attended Ford Hall lectures, which were adult forums, and so that she could learn about what was going on in the world. So she began herself, as a result of my education, to develop herself. And she learned to read English, and she could read novels. She read Tolstoy in English when I was growing up, when I was in college. And she wanted to keep up with me, that was clear. And she wanted to keep up with the ideas that were prevalent.
And rights for women, did that interest her at all?
No, she was never active in any organization. She never seemed to become involved. I think part of it was due to the fact that she always felt that she had never been educated enough to be able to cope with that type of thing. She was she felt inferior, and but she wasn't inferior. She was a person of great ambition. I don't think that she had a great mentality, but I think she had interests that were so much larger than her life, you know. And this was the thing, of course, that inspired me. That's all I had.
Did you feel pressure, a lot of pressure to do
no.
well?
No, didn't. No. All I knew was that my mother expected me to be a good student, so I was a good student, you know.
You didn't feel pressure and feel you should rebel
no.
against that? Or
no, as a matter of fact, when times became hard during my last years in college, I really should have worked for a scholarship, I went out to work instead, you know, during vacation periods and so on. And when I would bring home B's rather than A's, my mother would say, well, if you got A's, you could perhaps get a scholarship. I would say, well, I can't do that and work too. And she never, she was always very happy with everything I did.
Mm-hmm.
She never made great demands on me, but she knew that I knew she expected me to do well, you see. But she was quite, in that sense, everything I did, she thought was mine.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she applauded all my activities and everything.
Uh-huh.
So, yes, during my adolescence, while in high school, a cousin came from Russia to stay with us. He had been a revolutionary there, and when he arrived, he sought out the Boston Socialists as friends. This was my first contact with views that were foreign to my parents, who believed in individual initiative and the acquisition of wealth through hard work. This cousin spent many hours telling me how he arrived at his socialist views and his understanding of Marxism. When I entered college, I had some preliminary understanding of economics and the world in which I lived, largely through his influence. Yet my outlook was naive, and my knowledge of history almost nil. The impoverished cultural environment in which I had lived spurred me on to learn more of life and people. My college years were full. In the spare time I had, weekends and vacation periods, I had to work to earn pocket money. Mostly I found it hard to cope with the wealthy girls who seemed so self-confident and assured. I realized early that I was not of their class, that my future would have to be devoted to improving the lot of those who lived in poverty and could not achieve what I had. More and more, my thoughts turned to the need to prepare myself in college for the world outside, to aid in some way in social reform. But my views were most inchoate. After all, I entered Radcliffe at age 16 and was hardly mature when I graduated at age 20.
And you lived at home?
I lived at home. I was not in the dormitories or anything of that sort. And there was tremendous amount of snobbery and elitism at Radcliffe.
Oh.
Even to this day, they still like me, you know, to send them money. And I always say I have other priorities
right.
than Radcliffe because I have this long-standing antagonism to their elitism. There were Jewish girls, but first of all, they were anti-Semitic, but there were a couple of Jewish girls, but they were Susan Brandeis and,
uh-huh.
And Ruth Mack. Ruth Mack was the daughter of a judge, and Susan was, of course, the daughter of a very noted, by that time, I don't think he was justice yet. He might have been. Yes, he might have been in the Supreme Court already.
Court justice.
Yeah.
And you were friends with what type of people there?
Mostly, there were two black girls, mostly the black girls and the Jewish girls. There was one Jewish girl who came from a poor family who also, there were two Jewish girls who came from poor families who also were pulling themselves up by their bootstraps, so to speak. And both of these girls became my very good friends, and they were very, I would say, worldly and very wise, not narrow in their views. There were two other Jewish girls whom I used to see a great deal of, but both of those girls were really concerned with getting married and having children and not having any careers. And so that's what they did.
And the black woman that you were friendly with?
The black woman, one of them became very, I would say, withdrawn. And she was very competent, and I think she got a good job, and she probably never did anything else but work. The other one was the daughter of a, not the daughter, but the niece of a noted black attorney in Cambridge who used to entertain Du Bois and other people. And she would invite me to her home, and I met, what was the name of the other famous black man that I met there? Well, anyway, I met some noted black...
Garvey.
No. I met some noted black people
uh-huh.
through Nadine Wright. Her name was Nadine Wright. She is now living in Boston and married to, I think, a Jewish man.
Uh-huh.
But I have not been in touch with her since after I was married. I wrote to her and I think saw her. But when I became involved in revolutionary politics, I felt that she was probably not sympathetic, and so I didn't contact her. But someday I expect to go to Boston and see her. We were very close, dear friends.
Mm-hmm.
Now, let's see. Nevertheless, my friendships were made among girls who were poor or deprived, the two Negro girls in the class, and some of the more mature students who had worked for years before being able to enter college. Among them were two women who had followed the socialist movement, attending meetings and demonstrations, and through them I found companionship and friendship among socialists in Boston who welcomed me more warmly than the frigid aristocrats that constituted the population at Radcliffe. Soon I was to join clubs and attend meetings at Harvard where world politics were discussed. I found myself immersed in the study of economics and sociology, and in my junior and senior years my interests were almost totally directed to these areas.
What kind of socialism was this?
Well, for one thing, the Itzels were then very dominant, and Jessica Smith, who was a traveling organizer for the Itzels, came to Radcliffe once, and she had a great deal to do with my becoming interested in socialism. And then there were the old socialist movement in Boston, among whom Harry Wadsworth Longfellow, Dana, and one or two others. One was an attorney by the name of Birack, who was a prime mover, and several other people that I met who were intellectuals and professionals, but were belonged to the Meyer London type of...
My great-uncle.
Really? to that category...
My grandfather's brother.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That category of socialist. And, of course, at the time of the great... Of the Russian Revolution, these men expressed sympathy and concern, but later they separated out and opposed the Bolsheviks violently, and then I lost contact with them. But this I'll go
right. Okay.
Yeah. Now, my college years, while exciting and stimulating, were in many ways painful years. From the cocoon that represented my mother's tender, loving care, I was soon aware that I would have to face a world of struggle, and that my first priority on leaving college was a decent job to help relieve my mother of the enormous burden she had undertaken on my behalf. These years were also the years of World War I, and the threat of war at home was even more imminent. In 1915, when I walked with other feminists in the suffrage parade, I wondered whether the government would give an ear to women's rights when it was stirring up hatred for the Kaiser and seeking to justify entry into the European war. When the Russian Revolution exploded, I finally had to decide on which side I was. These were turbulent days among the students. There were endless meetings and discussions, and among the socialists, the feeling in support of the Bolsheviks ran high. Among the friends at Harvard I had met were Pedro Albizu Campos, the Puerto Rican nationalist, who later became an ardent revolutionary. Pedro was proud of his lineage. His father was a Spaniard and his mother of Indian and African extraction. He had suffered some discrimination, but his unusually high scholastic standing had forced the Harvard faculty to recognize his gifts. When I met him, he had just entered Harvard Law School. We became fast friends, and he visited my home frequently. In fact, our friendship extended to 1952, when I saw him for the last time before his death. He had just been released from a long prison term in Atlanta. Pedro was influenced by socialist thought. He had liberated himself from the Catholic Church and was something of a pragmatic personality with all his idealism. He would not accept fully socialist ideas since it did not correspond, in his view, with the needs of his country under colonial domination. Then there was Harry Wadsworth Longfellow Dana, who lived in the old Longfellow home, and often invited us to engage in discussions about the future of socialism now that the Russian Revolution had made the first break in the capitalist world. There were also many others among the Harvard students who were politically aware, but at Radcliffe, only a few showed any interest in the world outside their studies.
Much fewer women than men were socialists?
Oh, there were no socialists. I think that when we established
John Reed was there. Were those John Reed clubs?
Yeah, but I didn't know him. Oh. No, I didn't know him. I didn't know Corliss Lamont. He was there.
Yes.
But Corliss was a little later than I. Corliss
right.
is younger than I am. But I did know I did know one or two others who later disappeared from my life. I didn't hear from them anymore.
What about suffrage? There was an interest in suffrage, but those women were not social
well,
or class conscious?
Not especially. Altogether, there were, I think, 600 students at Radcliffe.
Mm-hmm.
So that the graduating class of 1917, which was my class, so you know my age
right.
now. 1907, out of my class, there were 150 students, is that right? Would that make up of 600, four times?
Yeah, that would
yeah,
right.
150 students, which is not very many.
And what about suffrage? Was that a big issue? No?
Not that I can recall. There were very few Radcliffe women who went to the Cosmopolitan Club meetings. That was the political club of Harvard. And that was the club where all these problems were discussed. But the Harvard men were not interested in women's suffrage particularly. They were interested, of course, in world politics, in the war, but not in women's suffrage.
How did you get to march on that parade then?
Well, I had identified myself, I think, around 1915 with the Jane Addams group.
Mm.
And there was a small peace movement in Boston. And I used to go to meetings, and I sort of oriented to them a lot. And when they announced a parade, I marched in the parade. I wasn't really a very active member, but in fact, I don't think I was even a paying member because I didn't have any money. Mm-hmm. But I was a very much of a supportive member, you know. So I marched in the parade.
And there wasn't a belief that those few women that were going to college then were exceptional.
There was no belief that these women would play any role in society. They were exceptional women, unquestionably. They were very capable women. They were all very bright. They came from very affluent families. I made a friend with one woman who later became a very dominant personality. Her name was Marion Hathaway. And Marion graduated in 1916. She was the poor niece I think an Episcopalian minister who had a church in Cambridge, and she lived with him, and she always felt that she was being she was being treated like a poor relative, and she had many personal problems. And she and I became quite friendly at Radcliffe. She was the only non-Jew, really, that I got to know very well. And I met her again when I went to Washington in Seattle. And there she was quite receptive of everything I was doing, gave me financial support, and in a sense was tremendously... She was an assistant professor, like as my husband was, in sociology. And she aligned herself with my husband on all of the political things that were happening on the campus.
But there was that much anti-Semitism that there was almost no relationship between the white, the Anglo-Saxon women and the Jewish women. What about Catholic
women? No, I think
women?
It was more of a class attitude on their part, not so much an anti-Semitic attitude, because they didn't know Jews very well.
Mm-hmm.
But they recognized that I was a poor girl, you see.
Uh-huh.
And they were not, you see. They had everything, and I think it was a class attitude. They looked down upon people of the from Massachusetts who didn't live at the dormitories and who were apparently day students, you know, and... There was definitely a class relationship there. One felt it everywhere, you know. You just didn't belong in my
still
class.
Was.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, let's see. Where were we?
Probably your... this is excellent.
Mm-hmm.
Harvard student. This is during my junior year, probably.
Yes.
I think that's what you're up to.
Yeah. Did I say that... There were also many others among the Harvard students who were politically aware, but at Radcliffe,
yes.
only a few showed any interest in the world outside their studies. Now, during my junior year, through the efforts of my mother, I met a daughter of one of her countrywomen. Martha Silverman was one of the early professionals who had succeeded, despite poverty, to gain a law degree and was distinguished in the Boston community for her outspoken advocacy of justice for the poor. She had been director of the Boston Jewish Charities, and when I needed work, I came to her to apply. She was eager to help me, and I became, through her efforts, the director of the Employment Bureau of the agency. It was hard to find employment for the many unfortunate men and women who came to the agency. Untrained in a city which was foreign to them, it required ingenuity to provide them with the wherewithal of life by their own efforts.
You didn't look for any other work. You didn't have an ambition to be a lawyer or a doctor. You didn't
No, I was anxious to get out of college to be able to work and help my parents. That was my ambition. I never thought of graduate work at all. I never thought of becoming a professional even, because there was no money. I didn't have the means, you see. So I had to immediately get out and work. And the possibilities for women in those days were very limited. You could either teach.
And you didn't want to teach.
And I didn't want to teach. Or you could do social work, and social work was very primitive in those days. So that, so this was in a sense a boon, because right. I had found something that only through the fact that my mother knew Martha Silverman's mother, you see, and Martha became interested in me. Although I too had experienced poverty, I had never known the kind of experience which the applicants to this agency had suffered, namely lack of food and tolerable housing conditions, without the necessities of life. I introduced a number of innovations in the work of the department, becoming more and more aware that private charity could not solve their problems. Upon graduation, the U.S. was already in the war, World War I. My cousins were threatened with the draft and were eager to fight. This is the type of cousins I had. All around me, there were strong feelings against the Kaiser and for American participation. So I was among the few in the community that joined the peace movement and was early outspoken about the war. I was drawing closer to the socialist movement, which was already undergoing serious schisms that were dividing the movement between left and right. Mrs. Silverman had asked me to return to a better job after graduation, and since I had few opportunities, I agreed. I became a field worker and was soon able to meet social workers from other agencies who were advocating legislation to overcome some of the degrading conditions confronting the poor. In a few years, I was elevated to supervisor, and when Mrs. Silverman left, supplanted by a professional leader in the social work field who sought to change the methods of relief for the poor, I was given even greater responsibility. It was really my first experience in social work that gave me the feeling that I had some leadership qualities, you see, and that gave me the opportunity to express that. Because I used to go to the State House in Boston very often and speak for housing legislation, and I used to speak to Jewish groups on the conditions of the poor and so on. I very early started this kind of a...
You started it, not the agency.
The agency was perfectly satisfied with my doing my 8 hours a day, you see. Mm-hmm. But I had larger interests than that, you see. Well, now, I'll go on. Choosing the south end of Boston as a pilot project for bringing the Jewish community to a greater state of self-help, I was placed in charge of the first local effort to establish a Jewish community project which would reach out to the Jews of all classes and would involve them in the responsibility of forcing legislative changes and other reforms beneficial to the poor and underprivileged. This was a project watched throughout the social work world, and many came to observe the efforts of the agency to inspire in the more privileged Jews the sense of responsibility for the development of their community and for their less privileged kinsmen. The experiment proved more successful than anticipated and gave me an opportunity to learn about the processes of getting improvements by legislation. Housing was one of our first efforts. Alas, when I returned to the South End 25 years later, little or nothing had been done to destroy the slums and improve housing conditions, and they're still bad. Some headway was made in getting playgrounds and recreation areas for the children, but these were not maintained. Other efforts were undertaken with minor results. All of this was to reinforce my views that only a drastic change in the society could make possible the many reforms required. I was becoming more disillusioned with my work, although it was considered eminently successful. It was at one of the many demonstrations of the community committees at work that I met Harriet Silverman, then a social worker who was later instrumental in introducing me to Grace McDonald. Grace invited me to join their efforts at the Workers' Health Bureau, which had opened its offices in 1923 in New York. The idea was exciting to me, to help the trade unions find the road to decent working conditions through their own struggles seem more fruitful than what I was doing, which was essentially philanthropic.
Well, did you know anything about the Sacco and Vanzetti case
yes.
going on there? Were you active in
yes,
that
Yes, but
all?
That came later. That was in 1927 and 28, and I was already married. And
so that wasn't Boston.
That was not in Boston,
no.
See. I was not in Boston. However, don't I speak of my experience in Lawrence, Massachusetts?
No.
Oh, I have to do that.
Oh, good. No, you should say something. Yeah, because Lawrence is 1912.
No, and 1920.
Oh, again, right.
Yeah.
The first Lawrence, right?
Yes, now let me see. Yes.
Let's see.
1912, but I was too young then, see.
Right.
I was only 15 years old in 1912. Now, let's see. Oh, I should have put that in. Let me see if I... Now, while a student at Radcliffe, I often visited my family in Haverhill and learned about the Lawrence strike in 1920. During a summer vacation in 1920, away from my social work responsibilities, I visited my family in Haverhill and also took the opportunity to visit Lawrence, which was only a trolley ride from Haverhill. When I got to Lawrence, the city was covered with police on horseback, and the railroad station and the various points where people gathered were all covered with police. Which was quite frightening to me. However, I found my way to the headquarters of the Lawrence strikers. They had already been on strike for a year. I think the strike broke out in 1919. And there was tremendous poverty and suffering among the people there. As I entered the hall, I noticed a tall, courtly-looking gentleman standing up and talking to groups of workers. So I approached him and told him that I was now the dates seem mixed up because it must have been earlier. See, I was a student then.
A student in high school?
No, in college.
And
so it must have been. I graduated in 1917. So it must have been 1916. There was a strike on then. So. But I think this was the 1919 strike, the 1919-1920 strike. My dates are a little upset, but anyway, it was, I'm quite sure, it was either 1919 or 1920, and I was already out of college. The man whom I approached was A.J. Musty.
Oh.
And I didn't know it until he introduced himself, and I introduced myself, and he was delighted that I came. And I said, could I do anything? I have a short vacation. I'm staying with family in Haverhill so that I have no expenses being here. And if I could be of any help, I'd be glad to. What he did was, not knowing me, of course, he went up to the desk and he said, well, I'll tell you what you can do right away. Take this $25 and buy $25 worth of stamps so that we can send out letters. Not knowing me, I thought it was tremendous confidence in a person, you know. I went to the post office, of course, and brought back the stamps. And then that afternoon, I licked stamps on envelopes. I wasn't happy with that arrangement, and I couldn't see any role that I could play. So I came back once or twice, but I didn't stay. And I met quite a number of the textile workers and talked with them and saw what their conditions were, and I was very distressed.
Was the Wobblies organizing that strike, or Mustyites, or...
Well, the Wobblies were there wasn't there was no t- there was no AFL union there,
no.
So it was the Wobblies were the organizers. Musty was simply a minister who had always identified himself with the workers and who came to help, and that was all he did. And he sent out letters, and that's about all you could do. I mean, the strike was a picket line, and. Apparently, the Wobblies had their own method of organizing, and they never called on anybody else except the workers to picket. So that my role was so limited that I felt I was wasting my time. But that was my contact with with a Lawrence strike. Now, we're now at the point where
you're going to work for the Workers' Health Bureau.
Yes.
Met Grace McDonald.
Yes, I met Grace, and Grace was rather taken with me and wanted me to come and work there. In the summer of 1923, I left the profession of social work and Boston forever. I had decided to join the staff of the Workers' Health Bureau. That social work could ever achieve reforms was clearly impossible. That it could help to suppress any rebellion on the part of the poor appeared to me to be closer to its purpose. It was, as I understood it then, a stretcher bearer of capitalism. My work with the Workers' Health Bureau, however, was delayed because I was soon to marry Bernhard J. Stern. He was both scholar and activist who had not yet found the road he wanted to travel. He had just obtained a degree of M.A. from University of Cincinnati and from Hebrew Union College. You know, he was the ordained rabbi. Right?
No.
But never became a rabbi. But was certain that the social problems he saw could not be resolved by either the clergy or philanthropy. He determined to become a physician. But unable to gain entrance in the medical schools, there was only a small Jewish quota, he had obtained admission to the University of Graz in Austria.
How did you meet him?
Well, I met him because, as I mentioned before, the pilot project, which we had undertaken in the south end of Boston, became rather well known in the social work field. And a new director came to the Boston Federation of Philanthropies, whose name was Maurice Hexter. Maurice Hexter was from Cincinnati, and he had met my husband there and had liked him very much. And he knew that my husband was seeking a way out. He didn't want to become a rabbi. He didn't want to do any work in that area, but he wasn't quite sure what he wanted to do. So he said to him, he wanted to lure him or entice him into the field of social work. So he said, why don't you come and see our pilot project in the south end of Boston? We have a remarkable thing going there, and you might become interested in that kind of community work. So he came to a special meeting that Hexter had called of various leading social workers in the country, and we put on an exhibition of our work by inviting our committee, our district committee, to participate in the discussion of the problems of it. And I was the secretary of the committee, so obviously I had to prompt the chairman and handle the work of the committee and sort of lead it. And that was when we met, became there.
And were there other men that you were interested in before this time?
Yes, there were. But I'm not going to talk about that because they're it's a little too... I think it's unnecessary to talk about your romances, you know. But
it's always interesting to other people.
Well,
part of the person that doesn't get
written. The person that I became involved with at Radcliffe was a very brilliant young man, but not a man of very great character. He was extraordinary in many ways, and I found that later he was very close to Norman Thomas, and he wrote a great deal for the Nation and the New Republic, but it was always anti the things I believed in. So we had a very very close relationship for about 4 years, and then we just parted company. And when I met my husband, that was really the end of the relationship with him. So but I met him in I think it was 1921. Did I say? Yes, but I had met him before, you see. We were married in the summer of 23, but I had met him in 21. And he was still very, very uncertain of what he wanted to do, and so he wasn't very amenable to marriage or anything. But he kept up his friendship with me, and it was a romantic friendship, you know. And finally he decided that since we were both uncertain of our futures, that maybe we'd better join and try to find a solution to our mutual problem. And that was when he decided that he would become a physician.
But you didn't consider that marriage would harm your career or...
No, and it so happened that he was the kind of person who was very eager for women to assert themselves. He had a very strong feeling about that, And he was in no way, he no way tried to influence me. When I decided that I would go to work at the Workers' Health Bureau, although we had already planned to be married, I wanted to go to see whether I would like it sufficiently so that after marriage I might stay. He had no objection at all. He as a matter of fact, never interfered with my professional interests at all, or my, shall I say, just my interest as a woman.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, he encouraged it a great deal. So that summer, that summer I went to work for the Workers' Health Bureau and left social work, although I had, by that time, gained a very high position and probably was one of the most highly paid social workers in the country.
Were you sending money to your parents?
I was living with my parents.
Oh.
and supporting them, actually.
Uh-huh.
I mean, paying the rent and doing all the things and refurnishing the house and making the house livable and all that sort of thing. And for those few years that I worked in social work, when my salary was constantly rising, I was in a position to do a great deal more for my family than I had ever been, you see.
And your mother was still working as a
dressmaker? My mother was, well, she wasn't working as hard then. She was working a little, but not as much. And my father was working, but earning very little. I left my family with a small nest egg of savings, and Stern and I set off for Europe. A sharp turn in our plans occurred when my husband became seriously ill, and instead of matriculating at Graz, we journeyed to Germany for what was then considered the best available medical care. We were in Italy then. We were on our we were on our way to Trieste, and then we were going to Graz in Austria, which was considered one of the best medical schools at the time. And he became ill in Venice, very ill. And this was because he had had an ulcer when he was age 16, and there was a recurrence of it. I guess the type of food we had in Italy was not the best for him. And so he became terribly ill, and we just decided we couldn't undertake a medical career under those circumstances. There he underwent drastic surgery, and upon recovery in late 1923, we went on to England, where both of us registered at the London School of Economics. I might say here that instead of going to Graz, we went to Berlin. And this was Berlin in 23, which was a very turbulent period. There was inflation. There was great suffering of the people. There was tremendous amount of political discussion everywhere. And wherever we went, even after his operation, there was a fear of a fascist putsch, and on the other hand, among certain people, fear of a communist revolution. So we experienced, both of us experienced the marching of the putschists and the fascists, and also the communists. We saw these things developing as we.
Did you have sympathy for the communists?
Yes, at that
time. Contact with them?
Yes, at that time. No, we didn't get contact with them because Bernard was ill and couldn't do very much. But at that time, the communists were very vocal, very articulate, and many of them were teaching in the university. So we registered for a while in the university. You see, there was a period there. We were there from September until December. So there was a period there when Bernard was able to get to the university. And
he spoke German, no talk.
Well, of course, he had his parents were German, and he had a German background, so German was quite natural to him. It wasn't to me. I spoke Yiddish, but my vocabulary in Yiddish was very helpful for me in German, and I learned German rather quickly. And we made friends. There were many expatriates and many students in Germany when we were there, in Berlin when we were there. Many of them were music students and came for the music, because there was a tremendous amount of music there, operas and concerts and so on. And during my stay there, attended a meeting with Thomas Mann, in which Thomas Mann spoke, and he was then an occultist who had lost faith in everything and saw only the mystery of life. And it was a very disappointing experience to meet him and find that he had reverted to occultism because he had so little. He was so despairing, had so little faith in the situation. It was a fascinating experience for us to be in Germany because we learned more about politics than we had ever known in the United States. And we recognized that that there was going to be a terrible outburst at one time or another. I mean, it was a sort of pre-revolutionary feeling about mm-hmm. about the atmosphere.
In the United States in 1919, did you experience any of the roundups or any of the fear of anarchism, or, you know, it was almost like a 50s period then?
Yes, well, the Palmer raids had occurred right. while I was still in Boston. And it was at that time that I met Bert Wolf and his wife. They were running from the Palmer raids, and they came to Boston under an assumed name. And they were steered to me by Harriet Silverman, who at that time had married one of the party leaders. I don't know whether I should mention his name or not, because William sure. Winestone.
Oh.
And so...
Of the painters.
What?
Of the painters.
No, you're thinking
oh.
of...
it's okay.
Yeah, I know who you're thinking of.
Yeah, you should just
continue.
Me,
yeah. Weinstock. You're thinking
right,
of Louis Weinstock.
Right.
Now, this is William Winestone. He's also still very active in the party. Of course, during the period between the time when I decided to go to the Workers' Health Bureau and had learned about all these developments, I made frequent trips to New York, and I met many of the people in the party. And I must say that when the Wolves came, they did not want to be known to many people, so we spent a great deal of time together. And I learned a great deal about the international communist movement at that time from him and from them. And he later was instrumental in bringing me into the Communist Party, Bert Wolf, you see, but not until much later.
And did they give you contacts in Germany of people to look
at? No,
no,
no, because when I met them, my plans were still, this was 1919, 1920,
mm-hmm.
and I hadn't even met my husband at that time.
Right.
In 1921, they had already left Boston and were back in New York, working very actively, and I didn't see them. But I did see Harriet, and I did see Grace from time to time. And it was that in 1923 that I decided to come to the
But you weren't attending YPSL meetings or...
No, I didn't. I didn't have the time. I was very busy. My
on
professional
your job.
Life was, yes. My professional life really consumed most of my time. I would spend very often every evening in the community center that we had. And I was... After I left the community center, before I went to New York, they had given me a further responsibility. I became a case supervisor. So I left the south end of Boston, and I was in the central office, and I was always very busy. However, I had contacts with many of the workers, with the unions, especially the Jewish unions. And because I knew Yiddish so well, the Jewish leaders... especially a man by the name of Max Hamlin, who was a prime mover among the mm-hmm. Jewish workers and a very charismatic personality. He very often involved me in the disputes that occurred. I was once an arbitrator of a dispute between the slaughterhouses of Boston and the Jewish workers who used to work in the slaughterhouses, you know, doing all of the dirty work that went
right.
on.
So
there.
Through even your social work contacts, you really met
oh, yes.
a broad range of
oh,
people.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Especially among the workers,
mm-hmm.
especially among the trade unions. And Max Hamlin recognized that I had socialist leanings, although I was not yet affiliated with any group. And so he was always involving me in the labor activity. And I met many other interesting personalities in the Jewish world, but not religious people. They were
mm-hmm.
mostly cultural
right.
Jews, you see. Now let's see. Where are we?
We are in Berlin.
Yeah.
And you're going.
We underwent drastic surgery, and upon recovery in late 1923, we went on to England, where both of us registered at the London School of Economics. I had also studied at the University of Berlin during the long illness and had learned to speak and read the German language. But mainly, our education in the politics of the times was profound. Germany was in the throes of rebellion. The vast masses were suffering to an incredible degree, for inflation was so rampant that one's earnings in the morning were worth almost nothing by the end of the day. You should have seen the workers with great big suitcases buses carrying their paper money from the factory. Every day they were paid, and they were paid according to the noon rate, and by the following morning the paper was worth nothing. It was the most tragic experience. Men and women both were reduced to begging on the streets, and I saw a number who fell dead from starvation on street corners. Attending political meetings, I learned of the various schisms on the left, of the attempted putsches by rightists, including Hitler, that failed in Munich. Parades and demonstrations were everywhere in Berlin, and revolution appeared imminent. When we departed for England, my husband was in frail health, and a medical career was now out of the question. He then decided to get a doctoral degree and devote himself to teaching. After completing the spring term at the London School and spending a few more weeks on the continent, we returned to live in New York. I was now more certain that I wanted to spend my productive life in the labor movement. Bernard registered at Columbia and received his PhD the following year, and I returned to the Workers' Health Bureau. Mm-hmm. Husband's experience was so intertwined with mine that I have great difficulty separating myself out from him, you know, because we were both we both did everything.
Together,
yeah.
All this time, you didn't have any children?
No.
Did you use birth control?
Yes.
I
went to the Margaret Sanger Clinic when I got back from Europe.
Uh-huh.
And I talked with them, and they gave me a diaphragm.
And did your mother never, did your mother say anything?
My mother didn't know. She didn't know why. She just thought I wasn't having children. She didn't question.
She didn't tell you about birth control?
No, she didn't even know.
How did you hear about it?
Well, I was aware of everything that was going on in the world, and I knew that Margaret Sanger had a clinic, and I knew that she was concerned with birth control, and of course she had had a great many, what is that word I want to use, with the police?
Encounters
with the police, right.
So that you were interested in that.
Oh, yes, and she was in the newspaper and so on. And she had a clinic down on West 16th Street.
Yeah, until a few years ago.
Yeah, and I went to that clinic and told them that I wanted to be protected against pregnancy for a while, until at least we knew where we were going.
Mm-hmm.
And they gave me a diaphragm, so it worked very well. And it was only when I decided that I wanted to have a child that I didn't use it. So,
yeah. Now, where were we? Back in the United States, returning to the Workers' Health Bureau.
Yes. Now, here again, I'm very much disturbed because our lives were so intertwined that I'm going to separate out my activity from his for a while. You know now that he got his PhD the following year, which was, I should put the date in, shouldn't I? 1925, yeah, 1925. And that year...
And did you meet people in London at all?
Oh, yes. Bernard was... you don't remember him at all, do you?
Not that well.
He had a remarkable personality,
uh-huh.
And he never seemed to have any fears about. He never had that reverence and awe that a great many students have for professors.
Uh-huh.
So he got to know several of the people there. I think Toynbee was teaching there, mm-hmm. and Ginsberg, whom he adored, who was a mm-hmm. wonderful man. I have his book here. And
you were studying as well.
Yes, I was studying as well.
What did you study?
Well, I didn't stay at the London School, mostly because of financial reasons. It was too expensive for me to go to school there. So what I did was I got a project for myself and worked at the British Museum every day while he was studying, you see. And my project was Rosa Luxemburg. And so I went to the and I was also of course interested in women.
Uh-huh.
So I studied. I read Mary Wollstonecraft, and I read all of that the Shelley Circle,
uh-huh.
you know.
Uh-huh.
And I took notes, very careful notes. And I thought when I got back, see Rosa had been assassinated in 1919, and her face and Liebknecht's face was all over Berlin. Mm-hmm. So I had become already quite interested, and I brought back with me some books of hers, which I later lost, unfortunately. And it was my intention on my return to do something about her. But I didn't have quite, I didn't have a very clear view of what I wanted to do, except that I thought I'd either like to translate her works or I'd like to write about her. And actually, I didn't do that until after Bernard's death. I now have some translated letters, and I'm going to give you a tape of some letters that I broadcast over WBII that I have translated.
Now, how did you support yourself in London?
Well, my husband had some money that he had saved, and so we didn't do any work. We had enough money to carry us mm-hmm. through. We had paid for our surgery in Berlin at a pittance, because the professor of surgery there was a very famous urologist by the name of Dr. Israel, who had operated on the Tsar of London, the Tsar of Russia. That's silly. And he was so bad, he was so hard up, he had so little money, that when he found out that he could get American currency, he operated on Bernard for $150. So you see, we didn't have too great expenses, and the dollar was very, very high in all the countries, so that we were able to live quite well on small amounts of money. And in London, we lived with a family by the name of Zuckerman, William Zuckerman, who later became at that time he was a reporter for the Jewish Morning Journal. He was knowledgeable both in Yiddish and English. He was a very brilliant man, and we had met him in Berlin. And his wife, they had just bought a house in London, in Stoke Newington, which is the heart of the slum of the working class area in London. And his wife was there alone, and he asked us if we would please go and live with her, because they had a big house and she was by herself. So we went there as paying guests, but it was very uh-huh. it was not very expensive. So we managed all right. Bernard had had quite a bit of money. His family had given him some money, and I left out everything I had with my parents, but he had enough for us, for both of us. So we managed all right. But by the time we got to New York, we were pretty broke.
Right.
And of course, immediately on our return to New York, Grace got in touch with me and said, "Oh, you must come back to the Workers' Health Bureau."
Uh-huh.
So I started working there. Now,
did you have any regrets about leaving?
No.
You didn't.
Leaving
the Workers' Health Bureau in the United States?
No, because I told them. You see, I came there in 1923, early, I think, in May. And I worked through until August. And I told them that I was, it was really